So, taking an MD, PhD at San Diego had become almost foreordained by the time you
well,
were doing it.
It was actually not exactly planned, because when I applied to medical school, I applied to medical school with the thought of going elsewhere. In fact, I applied to similar programs at other places, and I think I applied to six places, and I was accepted to all six, which is Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Washington University, St. Louis, Columbia, UCSF, and essentially decided to stay in San Diego. In part because I would finish quicker that way, and also in part because of the Regents Scholarship would fund me. And one of the disadvantages to some of the other programs is, in order to be in their MSTP program, you had to first finish the medical school and start, and then apply to that in your second year. So there wasn't the assurance you would actually be part of it. Whereas here, I was already doing it. I was already in the graduate program. One of the kind of curious things about that is the way I, not planned, of course, but the way this worked out, neither the graduate school nor the medical school knew that I was actually in the other school. So they actually thought there were two people with the same name. And the problem came about when the chemistry department wanted me to do my oral qualifying exam. And I told them I couldn't do it. I was taking pathology in the medical school. And then they realized, this was before the program had actually started, they realized that it was the same person. And they incorporated me in as the first official member of this MSTP program. So I actually ended up being in two departments simultaneously without the other one knowing about it.
Quite a juggling feat, wasn't it?
It wasn't intentional. I didn't go out of my way to do it. It was quite unusual.
Kept you quite busy, didn't it?
It was very busy.
Will you talk just a bit more about those graduate student and MD years?
Well, essentially, the equivalent of my senior year of college, where I was a first-year graduate student, I took the courses I was interested in biochemistry and did quite a bit of lab work. At that point, I decided to work in Jeff Rosenfeld's lab at the medical school for my thesis work, and I began working on the activation of hormone genes and pituitary by other hormones. I was looking at the regulation of gene expression. This was just at the point where, it's actually slightly before recombinant DNA became a possibility. And we were looking at messenger RNA levels using various techniques, and as other people were beginning to clone things, beginning to pick up on some of the ideas of how to do that. And then the next year, when I began as a medical student, I had a huge amount of coursework to do. And the first year actually went by okay. Towards the end of the first year and beginning of the second year, I realized that I was really not interested in everything they were teaching, so I ended up not going to class a lot of times, and I'd work in the lab, and as long as you passed the tests, there was no problem. So I ended up spending a lot of the time where I should have been doing gross anatomy, actually doing experiments in the lab.
So how did you pass the test?
I found actually that I could pass the test much easier by reading the books and studying than I could by going to lectures. And that some of the lectures were not very exciting or illuminating, and a lot of the students would spend all their time in class and really have very little to show after being in the class. And it was pretty easy, since this was a body of knowledge, not really anything being generated new, and not really teaching one how to think to solve problems. It was fairly easy. I say this in retrospect, it was a lot of work, but to learn the material fairly efficiently. Mm-hmm. Then after the first 2 years of medical school, I then which was planned in this program, took the time off, became a full-time graduate student. And by that time, I had enough work done and projects of my own going that I could finish in about a year and a half, I think. Finished my thesis work, went back and did the required clinical rotations, and finished both at the same time.
And your thesis was?
My thesis was on the regulation of prolactin gene expression by the hormone TRF. TRF was a small peptide hormone of three amino acids that was the first releasing factor, the first hormone released by the brain within control of the hormones. And it was actually discovered by Roger Guillemin, who was a professor here at the Salk Institute, who won the Nobel Prize for that discovery. So it was not only an exciting area to be working, but having this very distinguished scientist across the street who actually initiated that study was very awe-inspiring.
And this was in the chemistry department, was it?
It was in the chemistry department, though my work was actually done in the medical school. And the reason it was in the chemistry department was partly for the following reason. In the medical scientist program, one could choose any department that one wanted to do one's thesis. Most of the students chose biology because it fit closer with what they were doing. Because I started in the chemistry department, the only requirement the chemistry department really had was to pass four examinations in four fields: physical chemistry, organic, inorganic, and analytical chemistry. And most of the students didn't choose that because if they didn't pass physical chemistry, they had to take classes in it. And I happened to pass all four of them, so I didn't have any course requirements in that department. So it made really no difference to me to be in chemistry, even though what I was doing as a thesis was not really chemistry. It was really molecular biology.
You mentioned you did a couple of publications as an undergrad.
Yep.
Were you publishing as this work was going along, or not?
As the undergraduate work?
No, while you were in medical school and doing graduate work.
When I was in graduate work, I think the first paper I published from that was at the end of my first year of graduate work. And then as time went on, there were, I think 8 or 9 different papers that we wrote on various aspects during graduate work, some of which were primary research and some of which were review articles. We being myself and my thesis advisor. So what actually happened is I ended up doing the work and then writing the papers, and then he would edit and tell me where I was wrong, things like that.
Was that a relationship a particularly crucial one?
I think so. It was. It was and still is a very important relationship, not purely from a scientific point of view, but also I think on a warm personal basis. Partly because I had known I wanted to do molecular biology. In the chemistry department, I began working in the area of inorganic chemistry because that was the person that I worked for as an undergraduate. In the first few months as a graduate student, I actually continued that with the thought of becoming an inorganic or bio-inorganic chemist. And it became very clear to me very quickly that that really wasn't the area I wanted to work in. So I was then struggling with picking up, leaving one lab, while on good terms, not necessarily, I was leaving voluntarily, but it wasn't, they would have liked to have me stay very much, and I needed to find another lab I was interested in. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, worked at the medical school for a secretary in the endocrinology department, and we were talking about where I should go, what I should do, and she said, you have to go talk to this young guy, Jeff Rosenfeld, who, you know, has just come as an assistant professor. And I went to talk to him, and I was so excited by his enthusiasm and what he was doing that I then began to work in his lab and ultimately stayed there. And I was his first graduate student. Most students would hesitate to go into a lab and work for someone that has no track record, has never done really anything in science. And I think part of that was just the enthusiasm that he had himself and still has, and inspired in me. And I think in the long run it was a good choice.
So run me forward now. What happens as you graduate?
Well, then, as I was graduating, there comes another great decision point in one's life in that kind of a program. Do you go and be a clinician for several years and do the internship residency clinical approach, or the opposite is to say I want to do the PhD side of my life and go off and do a postdoctoral fellowship and then look for basic science positions. And at that point, no one is really sure what to do. The decision I made was to go ahead and do, at least try being a clinical doctor. I'd never done that before, except as a medical student. And I thought, if I'm going to decide not to do that for the rest of my life, I'd better be darn sure that I know what it is I'm not going to do. So I applied for internships and decided to go to Stanford, partly because it was, in my mind, a more intellectual atmosphere. The hospital and the basic science departments were in the same building. And so I went as a medical intern in the Department of Internal Medicine and did all the usual things interns do, stay up all night for 3 weeks at a time. But I also, it's clear my love was really in the laboratory and not in the clinic, though I actually enjoyed clinical medicine and was quite good at it. But I'd also been trying to figure out what to do at that point. And I had applied to Phil Leder's lab as a what was then called a medical staff fellow at the NIH. And that was a postdoc for MDs. And he accepted me into his lab, or his department. And I found out about the acceptance about the same time I was starting my internship. Spent a month doing that and said, nah, I'm going to, you know, go to the NIH at the end of this year. So I finished up the internship year, which allows one to become licensed as a physician. And at that point, moved to the NIH. And with the idea that I'll spend a year or two doing research and then maybe eventually we'll go back and do some more clinical work. But after being in that environment for a few months, it was very clear that that's really what I wanted to do. And that's what I've been doing ever since. The other thing that was a big change for me in going from both medical school and as an intern and then to the NIH was in the earlier two experiences, I was very unusual. There was virtually nobody else with the background that I had or with the interests that I had. And in medical school, most of the people wanted to go into private practice, and there were only a very few students interested in research. At Stanford, working in the hospital, there was virtually no interest. Everyone was interested in the patients, number one, and their real estate ventures, number two. And then when I went to the NIH, virtually everybody in the lab had the same background, the same enthusiasms that I did, because the lab was full of MD PhDs who wanted to work in the lab and who had almost the same kind of background that I did. So it was like coming home. It was a really exciting time.
That was good, not depressing.
That was very good to me. It was nice to find kindred spirits. Mm-hmm. where I had come from, there really wasn't any kind of kindred spirit. It also gives you a lot of reassurance that, you know, people value what you do. You're not really so unusual.
And that position at NIH, that was carried funding with it.
Yes, that actually was a one of these unusual positions that has since been discontinued, where one is appointed a commissioned officer in the military, in the public health service, which has a Navy rank with it. It became very popular during the Vietnam War as a way to keep physicians who didn't want to go into the military out of the military. And it also paid a lot more than the usual postdoc, so it was a regular job, but it was at the MD, at a clinical level for a young clinical person. And it had some other, we could go to the officers club at the Navy hospital across the street and get in, because we were officers and get these little cards that we would show them. And there are a few people who were in my same group then who are now still at the NIH, and they're now captains or something, you know, lieutenant commanders or something, but they don't make any more appointments and that kind of thing. So one of my greatest pleasures in moving back here was showing everybody my little Geneva Convention card, which says on the back that if you're captured by the enemy, you only have to give your name, rank, and serial number. And,
What about the research that was going on in this lab? And
well, the thing that attracted me to that lab was primarily the work that Phil Leder and his colleagues had done on essentially solving the problem of antibody diversity, which is how one can make a virtually infinite number of antibodies from only a few genes. And that was a major enigma. And the solution to that, of course, is that the genes rearrange in development, which no one had predicted, but which turns out to be an elegant mechanism for doing that. And a number of labs, Susumu Tonigawa, who's actually he was a graduate student at UCSD at the same time I was an undergraduate, won the Nobel Prize for that. A lot of us think that Phil Leder should have shared it with him, but the Nobel Committee didn't agree. But the piece of work, in essence, was to show that genes recombine. And that discovery was made and published immediately before I began looking for places to go. And you know, I found that one of the most exciting scientific discoveries that one could conceive of, because it was so elegant and so simple and such a beautiful mechanism. So that was really the work that stimulated me to look in those areas. You want me to keep?
Yeah.
Okay, keep talking. So when I entered the lab, it was at a transition point for that group. Phil Leder was a department chairman who had a number of other people in his department that he worked with. His laboratory worked on immunoglobulin genes, and when I decided to go there, that's what I had thought I wanted to work with. And when I got there, the first thing I realized is the lab was very big. There were a lot of people working on various aspects. And the major problem of immunoglobulin diversity had been solved. In fact, there were a lot of other things that were interesting to work on. But the real beauty is in the one elegant mechanism. And at that time, John Seidman was a postdoctoral fellow of Phil Leder, had just finished and was offered a job at the NIH, accepted that in the same department. And he worked, his idea was to begin to look at major histocompatibility antigens, and that is a class of proteins that determine tissue type. It determined whether skin grafts would be accepted or rejected between different mice, and very little was known about that. So I essentially, after talking to a lot of people in the department, decided to work with John, because I thought that was such an important problem and also had the potential for really uncovering something really unique. So I went there actually to work on one problem, and within a few weeks switched around to doing something else. And I think in the long run that was a good decision. I'm still fascinated by histocompatibility antigens. And at that time, no one had applied molecular biology to that problem, and we were some of the first people to clone and understand the structure of those genes.
What at that moment, you were still fully funded, and describe the lab structure to me, the number of people,
well,
and
the lab,
the nature of the group.
The laboratory was called the Laboratory of Molecular Genetics, which is a department that had Phil Leder as the head and about six other investigators. Phil had a group that was very large, probably about 20 to 25 people, and occupied about half of the entire department.
When you say people, how many of those were?
Oh, probably 12 to 15 doctorate level postdoctorals, several technicians, one graduate student, in fact, who's also a Pew Scholar now, Phil Heater, and in fact, a postdoc, Jeff Ravitch, who's also a Pew Scholar, and then various other visiting scientists who were there. So the entire number of people in that group was about that. The remainder of the people, the principal investigators, would have maybe one or two people in their lab. John Seidman, when he started his lab, initially had two people, maybe three, but I came at almost the exact time he started his own lab. So initially he was the principal investigator, and there were two postdoctoral fellows, myself and David Margulies. And then soon thereafter, two more came. But the group was essentially five people at that time.
So you were in a little spin-off group from this?
We were in a little spin-off group, but it was enough.
It's almost like cell division.
No, it is, but it was also very integrated, in that the lab meetings that we would have would be the entire group, Phil Leder's and John Seidman's. So we would present our findings and talk about our work with all the people working on immunoglobulins, and also people that were working on oncogenes at that time in Phil Leder's group. So we actually had the best of both worlds. We had all the connections and the contact with this world famous group, yet we weren't just one of, you know, 20 people all doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. At least from my mind, that was an advantage.
How is that sort of scale thing playing out? Do you see any changes in the business in the time that you've been in?
I think that there are changes, and that it's more difficult, at least in my mind, it's more difficult now to work with a small group than it was at that time. Part of that is, I think science in some ways moves in waves. And when a new technology is developed, or a new approach, a new idea, there's a wave of activity. For instance, DNA sequencing or protein sequencing, when that was derived, and DNA sequencing, where all of a sudden a lot of things that were difficult before become very easy, and there's a huge amount of activity. And then it dies down over a period of years because one's waiting for the next breakthrough. And what I see now is, in some ways, some of the things that were easy before, you know, are passé, but there's this new set of things on the horizon, and that one of the things it requires are more people, larger groups. The other thing it requires is automation, which is one of our...
You're talking about when you're what's on the horizon?
Well, what I see on the horizon, if I guess I can step back and explain this, one of the major discoveries that affected the way I look at things was first the structure of DNA. And after that, there was a flurry of activity in uncovering RNA and tRNA and many different things. And it began to slow down in the mid-1970s, recombinant DNA. And then instead of, we could clone genes, and we could begin to look at individual genes in detail. That's been going on now for 15 years or so. It's beginning to slow down. And now what's on the immediate future is the idea of analyzing entire genomes at once, and it's an increase of several orders of magnitude in scale. I say this partly because one of the things we're very heavily involved in now is how to map chromosomes, not just single genes. And so I can optimistically anyway foresee that in 10 years the kinds of things we do will be completely different than what we do now. We'll be dealing with millions of bases, not just thousands of bases. But in order to do that, we don't yet have all the tools that we need. We're developing, we as the scientific community in general. But those kinds of approaches now require a lot of people. You can't do it with just one or two people. It requires a lot of hands and different kinds of expertise.
Do you see that impinging on how life goes on at Salk, for instance? Can you see it?
Well, I think it clearly will impinge on how an institute like this works, because there's a lot of talk about cottage industry versus big science. I think there will still be cottage industry, which is what we do now, but I think it's moving towards the idea of teams working rather than individual investigators. It's not that the individual investigators can't work very effectively, but they have to work by coming up with entirely new creative ideas. If they want to do the same kind of thing everybody else is doing, it requires more people. I actually would rather be doing, you know, the clever things that one or two people would be doing, but it's difficult to come up with an entirely new approach.
Can you see, can you actually see changes in the organization of the structure here and elsewhere, and in the size of the groups, in the number of people in the cottage? We all look at clouds on the horizon, yeah, and wonder, but yeah.
This institute is actually a good example of the kinds of changes that occur. When it was first founded in 1965, early 1960s, and was built and people were recruited to come here, there were really only six labs. There were six fellows of the institute who were scientists of very high reputation, who had very, very large groups. And Renato Del Becco's lab, for instance, who was the person I originally worked with when I was in high school, was a group that took up this entire floor, or the floor above us, but it was an entire wing, and probably 50 people. What happened was that turned out... Can I take
sure.
one quick break?
Okay.
So there were several very large groups. One of the more successful ones was Roger Guillemin's group, which was probably at least 50 people. But that group was responsible for starting an entire new area of science, the area of neuroendocrinology. They were the group that, as I mentioned, discovered releasing hormones, and Guillemin won the Nobel Prize for that. But in to do that, to purify these things, they collected 100,000 sheep hypothalamine in order to extract the substance, which is, you know, a very small piece of tissue. It required a very large group. So the institute was founded with that in mind. But as time went on, it turned out that many of those groups were financially not very efficient, and that they got very large, but they weren't very productive. They weren't very productive in bringing in grants. And for a while, the Salk Institute was in serious financial trouble because of these large commitments. So it then moved to the idea of the small laboratories, one investigator with a few people, which is now what the majority of the institute is. And the idea was that those were more productive per capita. They were also more financially feasible. You could raise more grants for these small groups. And I think that's probably true. But I almost see it now moving in the other direction, which is to compete on some of these larger projects, which is really the direction molecular biology is moving. It's moving towards a larger group again. So it's almost evolving back. I'm not sure it's going to be only six laboratories, but you can see a change.
So Salk actually was in big science almost before it was there.
Was in big science from the beginning.
Yeah, I see. Okay, let me take you back into NIH and your little group, and can you talk a little bit about what you were doing there, and were those years? Where are the crucial breakpoints in intellectually in what you've been doing?
I think the approach that one had at that time, and probably still true, is one can define what the problem is. That is, what piece of biology do we want to understand? And what that requires is understanding the structures of the proteins and the genes that are involved in it. And then from a technical point of view, in order to do it, one has to clone the gene. So the entire search or effort is to clone the gene. It's getting easier as time goes on because there are many newer techniques. But at that time, the entire effort was to clone the gene for the major histocompatibility protein. And so when I went to the NIH, which was just after leaving a clinical internship, with all the insecurities that involves, being out of the lab for a year, not going into a new field, not knowing whether you can compete and remember all the things you have to remember, went into a lab that was very new. The director of the laboratory was about 2 years older than myself, so he was essentially a peer rather than